Today at Reader's Corner, the second half of our conversation with Ryan Pilgrim about her book Pushed Out, Contested Development and Rural Gentrification in the U.S. West. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. What happens to rural communities when their traditional economic base collapses? When new money comes in? Who gets left behind and who takes their place? In her book, Pushed Out, Contested Development and Rural Gentrification in the U.S. West, sociologist and Idaho native Ryan Pilgrim offers a rich portrait of Dover, Idaho, whose transformation from tribal land to thriving timber mill town to economically depressed small town to trendy second home location over the past four decades embodies the story and challenges of many rural communities. The book explores the structural forces driving rural gentrification and examines how social and environmental inequality are written into these landscapes. Based on in-depth interviews and archival data, Pilgrim grounds this accessible ethnography in a long view of the region that takes account of geological history, settler colonialism, and histories of power and exploitation within capitalism. Ryan Pilgrim is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Idaho. She received her PhD from the University of Oregon, and she spent her youth in Dover, Idaho. Ryan Pilgrim, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks.
If I could use a quote of yours, at one point you say, rural gentrification should not be seen as a new phenomenon, but rather the expected outcome of a social system that privileges the economic growth of the few over other ways of organizing social life. You apply the term spatial fix to what happened in Dover, where there needs to be a building of space for capitalism. And I'd like to run through a list of forces that seem to be at work that killed the timber economy in Idaho and does not allow for this lumber mill in Dover to come back, even though it burned down. Let's start with automation and consolidation.
You know, this was not what really my area of expertise when I started writing this book, but I am a person who just likes to know all the things. And so I started going down the rabbit hole, trying to figure out how many workers lost their jobs in this period. And one of the things that was really frustrating, I learned pretty quickly working with some people, was that we changed the way we counted timber workers between like the mid 70s to the mid 80s. And so you can't really count how many people lost their jobs. But one of the things that I thought, and I think you brought this up in the previous show, was the number of mills that had decreased over time in North Idaho. And this was fascinating to me because I sort of knew this, right? That just looking around, that I think between 1979 and 2006, the number of mills in Idaho decreased from 133 to 38. All right, so you're like, oh, here's this huge loss. So you can see it in our communities, all these mills closing, and Dover's one of them. But the amount of lumber produced in North Idaho actually increased in every reported period between 79 and 2006 from 930,000 board feet in 79 to 1.2 million board feet in 2006. And so you can ask yourself, well, how can these two things be true, right? How can we have fewer mills but more lumber? Well, the answer to that is that we automate things. We make it easier for work to be done with fewer employees because employees cost a lot of money. So that is a huge story about extractive industry that I think we overlook, that the mining industry is the same way. You need fewer people to do the same work because we have machines that do a lot of that work. I mean, that's the short version of that story.
Right. How about NAFTA and Canadian lumber?
Oh, this is, so NAFTA, I think it's interesting. I think Canada subsidizes their timber industry in a way that the U.S. doesn't. So it was cheaper to bring timber across the border and have it milled in Idaho. So that's another part of the story. So we're still doing a lot of the milling, but we're not doing much of the cutting in Idaho. So NAFTA, the free trade agreement, that comes in 95. So it's kind of after the story in Dover, but it's certainly a really important part of the story of timber in Idaho. It certainly impacts it. I know there's some quotes in the book from some of the journalists in North Idaho who covered these, that, you know, 90% of trucks moving south from Canada were full, and but only a third of those heading north were empty, right? So Canadians are logging, and that impacts Idaho jobs.
Right-to-work laws, and I have to mention, for the benefit of our listeners who might not have heard last week's interview, I think you said that in 1989, the lumber mill in Dover went union, and it burned down 3 years later. We'll just leave that as an interesting coincidence, but now you have this right-to-work law. You might explain what role that plays in making it even more difficult for unions to exist and demand a fair wage.
Yeah, so Idaho becomes right to work in 1985. And that the short version of that is that right to work makes it very difficult to form unions because of the number of people who have to sign their union cards to become part of the union. It makes it very almost impossible to engage in collective bargaining. Idaho is the only state that becomes right to work in the 80s, which I found really, really fascinating. And so, you know, a lot of the people I interviewed for the book talked about how good the job was in the 70s, right? That people talked about, you know, raising their family in Dover, being stay-at-home moms, and having their babies paid for when they went to the hospital, and great health insurance and wages that were enough to raise a family. So, you know, North Idaho had been a hotbed of labor organizing and activism since the 19-teens. And right to work really changed the labor politics of particularly North Idaho. We've really seen the political system politics change dramatically in North Idaho since right to work was put in, and wages and other things.
Well, and frankly, you see an interesting change in the politics of the state of Idaho, because there was a time when Democrats like Cecil Andrus, who I think even came from the timber economy, and Frank Church as Democrats could get elected. Well, days are gone. And if you wonder how did they get elected, they oftentimes got elected because they had the support of union workers. They had the support of unions. They had the support of the working class in Idaho. And that working class is no longer organized. Again, thanks to Right to Work. Let's move right along with another one, and that's the spotted owl. I use that as an example of environmental laws in general. And in this case, I came away from your book feeling like it was just so difficult. I mean, well, forget the takeaway from your book. I don't want to lay this on you, but I'll say it, that some of these reasons, like right to work, NAFTA and Canadian lumber, automation and consolidation, sometimes those aren't the easiest for people to understand who are just trying to get to work on time, bring home a paycheck, and get dinner for the kids. They don't have time to read up on all this stuff. But when somebody takes the bogeyman like the spotted owl and throws him up there into the air for everybody to see, I mean, I was living in the Midwest at the time, and I knew all about the spotted owl and the problems it was creating for the Oregon timber economy. Everybody knew about the spotted owl. But it's so much more complicated than that, is it not?
I mean, I think it is. And I think that was one of the stories I was trying to tell in this book. I think people, yeah. So I think it's much more complicated. And I will say, like, as somebody, and I have nothing but love for my teachers that I had in high school and in Sandpoint. And many of them have been my biggest supporters of this book. So, but I was, maybe this isn't something you learn in high school, but I was just frustrated that I didn't understand my own history very well. I grew up in a ranching community that had a lot of crises during the farm crises in the 1980s. And I also didn't understand my own place in history. And I think this book was an attempt to try and understand, like, that place in history. And I had certainly grown up hearing about things like the spotted owl and the environmentalists who hate ranchers and they hate loggers. And I drew heavily from a book called Empire of Timber, I think. I'm not getting the name right. I have to look at my works cited. But trying to understand what is the relationship between the environmental movement and the labor movement, because at one time they were heavily invested in each other's stories. And I think the spotted owl is interesting in Idaho because, of course, we don't have the spotted owl in Idaho. But our timber industry was consolidating and at the same time, contracting at the same time that all these controversies are happening. And it's easy to find kind of a scapegoat. And I think environmental policy, it's certainly the Roadless Wilderness Act certainly impacts timber in North Idaho in the timber industry. It pushed a lot of logging onto private lands, which is where most logging happens now in Idaho. I don't want to say that it didn't impact the local communities, that it doesn't impact a lot of the way our school funding works in Idaho. But, you know, many of these were economic decisions made by the timber industry that are rational economic decisions, right? So the timber industry moves a lot of their warehouser, moves a lot of their logging to the southeast because their mountains are shorter. They don't have the kind of dramatic forest fires we have, that it's just a less risky operation. And probably workers were cheaper there at that time too, right? So a lot of that, it also moves globally. And one of the things I'm always trying to get, I teach classes on rural sociology for my students to understand, and I hope my readers to understand, is that rural communities are part of our experienced global forces, but often are not given very clear, because of what's happened to local journalism and other things, it's hard to understand how our experiences are tied to these global forces, right? How is the timber industry in North Idaho being impacted by timber in Tennessee, right? How are these things connected? But they're certainly connected.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Ryan Pilgrim, author of Pushed Out, Contested Development and Rural Gentrification in the U.S. West. In the book, A Small Town in Idaho Weighs the Economic Compromises of Growth in the Rocky Mountain West. Do environmental regulations always protect communities from the whims of the developers?
No, and I think that's one of the takeaways. You asked such good questions because you read the book. I mean, I think that was one of the takeaways from the book for me was, you know, it's no wonder that these environmental regulations cause so much anger and consternation in rural communities because, you know, one of the examples in the book is the wetlands. So one of the ways that the community tries to stop development, and it's not really the old timers, but some of the people in Dover that try to stop development, is by using environmental regulations. So particularly wetland protections through the Army Corps of Engineers. And so they're trying to stop this and saying that the developer hasn't filled out the right permits and going back and forth. And I FOIA'd all of these permits. And one of the things I realized that at some point, I think the developer kind of decides, well, okay, uncle, I'm going to quit applying for these permits. I'm just going to let individuals apply for permits to fill in. You can fill in up to a tenth of an acre without getting it permitted. So the developer fills in almost no wetlands, but leaves it up to individuals as they build their homes to fill in the wetlands. What that means for the people of Dover is that pretty soon some guy's horse pasture is flooding. And he has more than a tenth of an acre that's flooded. And now he has a wetland on his property that he can't fill without getting a permit. Right. And so the ways, and Idaho is particularly bad. One of the wetland managers I talked to said, you know, Idaho's got these rules where, yeah, we don't really have to take into account the people upstream in the way certain places, maybe in Washington, might. So, you know, these policies, these environmental protections are meant to protect the wetlands. The developer can buy credits to protect wetlands in other spaces so that, you know, the same region has the same amount of acreage of wetlands that are being protected. It's just not on the development now. They've bought wetland protections, you know, in a different space. But a working class person who's owned a couple acres next to this mill that's now a development that now has half their pasture flooded really has no recourse that they can afford. And so, you know, that makes people feel angry when the riprap has to go around the lake to protect, you know, the shoreline so it doesn't erode. That environmental protection means that now those people can't launch their boats into the river. And so those protections, the upper class, the kind of development class, are able to buy their way to solutions around these protections. So they see them as sort of these communal goods. But for working people that have used these lands for generations without causing harm, I might add, right? That's part of the story. This feels really unfair. And it's easy to be like, well, I'm mad at this wetland protection because it didn't protect me. Or I'm mad at this riprap because now I can't put my boat in the water. It feels really unfair. And I think it is unfair, frankly.
You mentioned the difference between a lumber economy where workers are going home at the end of the day with a living wage and the new economy, the new service economy that is really pretty stark for workers who oftentimes suffer dramatic drops in wages and salaries. I have to admit, I did not understand the difference between Idaho's minimum wage of $7.25 and Idaho's minimum wage for tipped workers, which is, what is it, $3.25 or something like that?
I think it's $3. It was $3.35 about 6 months ago when I checked. I don't think it's changed. Yeah, so the tipped minimum wage in Idaho is $3.35 an hour.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess where I'm going with this is when you look at Old Dover today, and again, we didn't talk about this, but Old Dover does still exist. I mean, sure, there's mm-hmm. Dover Bay, but looking at the map at the beginning of your book, you show the parts of Dover that are the old timers, so to speak, and the people who are living in homes that are much less glamorous than the ones on the lake that are multi-million dollar homes. And, you know, I'm coming back to this. And again, I'm here in Boise, closer to McCall than I am Dover, but the same thing's happening in McCall. McCall was a lumber mill town once upon a time, just a lot older than the Dover experience. And, you know, you got this housing shortages and you have housing price increases that are making it very difficult for people who've been working in the service industry to find a place to live. But then once they do, they're stuck with a wage that is not a living wage. I mean, it's just, and I assume that's what's going on in Dover right now. Of course, it's going on across the state of Idaho.
What's happening every, I mean, I'm sure you follow the story of the tent cities being put up in Ketchum for service workers. Sandpoint restaurants are closing left and right in Sandpoint in large part because they can't find workers. I mean, COVID has, you know, I think this book came out at a really interesting time. It's timely, but COVID made it 10 times more timely because it's like all these forces that I'm kind of saying, like, these things are going to have consequences. We have to pay attention to these. I hadn't really anticipated that like 6 months after the book came out, it was like, oh, see, these are the consequences. Yeah, I mean, it's not a livable wage. I think that's like an understatement, that it's exploitive. You know, I think in the book, one of my favorite lines that I wrote, and I don't know if I can find it, but that people who used to clear timber are now clearing tables for $3.35 an hour. And, you know, it's not sustainable. People can't live on that. They can't afford housing on that. And, you know, I've been teaching on this all term in my rural sociology class. Like, I don't think that the alternatives, unfortunately, are very clear. You know, what does, that they are not, you know, as a sociologist, my answer is like, the answers are not easy. But they are probably structural. And we have to understand that what's happening, and we know this, especially in Boise, that what's happening in California impacts Idaho. What's happening in China impacts Idaho, right? And we know this on particular industries, but to understand ourselves within these kind of global systems and to ask for the kind of changes that can impact our communities within these global structures. And there are certainly things, you know, I know I've been sort of following Teton County a little bit. I had a reader who reached out to me, so I'm on a bunch of their development Facebook pages and just kind of following that. You know, people are working hard to try and create the communities that they want to live in that support everybody. And I think sometimes even if your city council cares a lot and you have all these good intentions, that these just don't seem to be the problems that we have the political will or the political interest in solving right now in Idaho. And I don't understand why, frankly, or maybe I do, but I just can't accept it.
Right. I should point out that there is a state law that says if a service worker, let's say a restaurant worker, doesn't come up with $7.25 minimum
an hour,
wage,
then their employer covers the difference.
The employer covers it the rest. Now, I don't know whether that's really happening everywhere. Who knows? And big deal. You're at $7.25. What's that get you anywhere in the state of Idaho? Let me move on to another issue. And this is a very small point of your book, but it gives I hope it'll give you an opportunity to help our listeners understand this from 30,000 feet, let's say. At one point, you document the change in ownership of the mill, where the reason for it apparently had to do with creating new legal ownership that allowed them to escape taxation. And I thought that was just such a perfect example of how, let's call them timber barons, that's who they are, getting these enormous advantages and then turning around and deserting the working class community like it happened in Dover. Am I right about that?
Like, as a corporation, Weyerhaeuser, yeah. And that was fascinating to me, like, when I went to the Weyerhaeuser's website and was trying to read about all their land acquisitions and things that they are, yeah, turning towards these new ways of using the land so that they can get tax incentives. Yeah. I don't talk much about it. It's kind of more of an aside, but I think it's, I mean, working people, everyday people. And I think most of us don't see ourselves as working people, but most of us are working people, not too much more than like a paycheck to paycheck, right? The system is not really designed for our success. And we can see that maybe most obviously through like housing and things, because it's literally built. So you can see that inequality in the environment built around us. But it's in all sorts of spaces too, which I try to kind of allude to in the book, around like the way that laws and some of the laws in Dover through the city ordinances in Dover change when the development gets put in and things like that, that thinking about all these different kind of capitals that we have, financial capital, but then also political capital and social capital and cultural capital, and how those come together to create our experience of the world. And if, you know, that's the hallmark of gentrification, is not necessarily this population change, but it's about shifts in power and who has power in a community to kind of, and whose interests are met in that.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Ryan Pilgrim, author of Pushed Out, Contested Development and Rural Gentrification in the U.S. West. I mentioned in the intro the research and the archival data that you relied on. And yet, when it comes time for the 3-1 vote, which authorized the new Mill Lake development, not all the records were intact when you went in search of them. You found blank tapes and missing notes. You don't say it, but the reader has to look at this and say, what's going on here? Did somebody get something for this vote? It wouldn't be the first time in American politics that that happened, but you may want to defend the three people who voted for this here.
I think that's a misreading maybe I miswrote it. I think okay. So the people who voted for the development at that point, one of the things that I realized that people had put so much time and energy and anger into trying to stop this vote, the property had already been rezoned like 10 years. Maybe 5 years before this vote was taken place. And it was, they were forced to rezone to, the city of Dover was forced to rezone to get land to build their sewer system. And it was court order that they rezone. But yes, there were an entire box, 26 tapes from the debates around the development, and they were all blank. And I mean, I have my theories about why they're blank, but you know, I don't know if they're super sociological about, they're not very sociological. They're more sort of personal.
Nancy Drew?
They're my Nancy Drew. And I'm always like, well, if a journalist wants to write about this, like, I've left you all the crumbs you need to try and write this. But my job, I see my job is to try and like, look at the structural forces and trying to write this kind of historical story to say, here's what's happening. You might want to use this to understand the kind of the forces that feel very much like things that are outside of our control. And in some ways they are, but I think to be able to name them, to be able to say, this is what I see happening. And I just had someone who read the book the other day and was like, oh my gosh, now I can see why making sure that our water system works in our community is so important. I hadn't realized how vulnerable it made us as a community. I thought it just made us vulnerable, like as individual homeowners, right? So I think that's my goal, is to try to create this this map for people. And it's a complex map of like the economic forces and the social forces that are at work in this place. And to say like, this map might help you understand what's happening in your own community. And to try and push down my Nancy Drew impulses and to say that, yes, most of the time when these things are happening in communities, if there's a finger on the scales, it's not on the scales of the people themselves, but the people on the city council, I have to say, I think the people that the people of Dover elected, they were all working class people who were part of the Dover Girls, who had these deep roots in the community and wanted to do right by their community, but were not really given a lot of many opportunities to make different choices because of the ways that that history is kind of constructed.
A history that is repeated over and over again across America, certainly across Idaho. And to me, that's the reason why Pushed Out by Ryanne Pilgrim is so absolutely critical for Idahoans to read, because it really does tell the story of who we are today, but more importantly, how we got there. And then let people think through, so where do we go from here? And I'm not asking you that question, Ryanne. I'm just saying that I think your book poses that question in the blank space after the last page of the book. And that's a great challenge.
I think that was my goal, was for that to be a question for communities to take on, that I don't give a lot of answers here. It's like, here's what I see. Yeah. I hope that this helps you see your community more fully.
Yeah. Well done. And thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Ryanne Pilgrim, the author of Pushed Out, Contested Development and Rural Gentrification in the U.S. West.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It was a pleasure.
In Ryanne Pilgrim's Pushed Out, we learned of the cultural political divide between environmentalists and those focused on the jobs and the overall economic needs of the community, which is played out in any number of Western communities. There's an interesting new novel that could serve as a fictional partner to Pushed Out. Damnation Spring is written by first-time novelist Ash Davidson, who was raised in Northern California in the midst of the giant and iconic redwood trees, which have graced the landscape for millenniums. At one point in the history of the land, there were thousands of acres of redwoods, now reduced in size by 95% thanks to commercial logging. Although these two books were not intended to play off one another, Damnation Spring, authored by Ash Davidson, is a fictional account of the clash between environmentalists and those who rely on logging for their livelihoods. Given her roots in Northern California, Davidson knows her stuff when it comes to the redwoods and logging. With her vivid portrayal of loggers climbing these monstrous trees, aided by sophisticated tools of the industry, the reader is inserted into this clash of cultures between long-haired hippies, as the novel identifies them, and the local townspeople entirely dependent on logging as a way of life. In Damnation Spring, there is also the spraying of defoliants that seem to be having a serious impact on the health of the locals. Even with the evidence presented showing why their illnesses may be related to chemicals sprayed over their communities, they reject the science in favor of logging jobs that pay the bills. It doesn't take much of an imagination to relate the logger's plight to our present-day pandemic and a vaccine that science has proven can keep people safe from the virus. But just as the loggers refuse to accept the reality of their circumstance, so too do our current-day anti-vaxxers who choose to place their faith somewhere else. Damnation Spring and first-time novelist Ash Davidson made it into a book review in the New York Times. It's not often a first-time author grabs a header in the Times that reads like this: "From towering redwoods to tiny creatures, this novel has it all." I picked up the novel at the bookstore because I saw the connection to the issues raised in Pushed Out by Ryanne Pilgrim. It's a story of rural gentrification. Although the two communities face different kinds of challenges to their way of life, they have much in common as to how the locals regard science, and both works show how challenging it is getting these two opposing forces, environmental activists on one side and those who work the land on the other, to find common ground. That is the challenge, and that is what you can read by picking up a copy of Damnation Spring by Ash Davidson. And don't be surprised if you tune into Reader's Corner a few weeks from now and hear the author tell her own story of Damnation Spring. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.